This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 160.
I always ask when we're the group talking about this, the people who are there, if your kids came to you and said, gee, mom, dad, I've got this first job and I can either work remote or be in the office, what do you think? Everybody says, be in the office. If you think about what it is you learn from being in the office, beginning your career, you learn from watching, which you can't do remotely. You can learn how interactions go, what irritates people, what makes people happy. You can learn what kinds of conversations are constructive, which ones are not. You can learn what's really going on with projects, as opposed to what you might read in a memo. So you find out the culture of the place from seeing the norms and values reflected in people's behavior. And you don't get any of that if you are remote, and particularly at the beginning of your career.
Even simple things like the informal interactions, as Peter is saying, those quick hallway chats, the spontaneous ideas over coffee, the small signals of trust and connection that simply don't happen in a scheduled Zoom meeting. So those moments, they don't show up in like productivity dashboards or anything, but they are vital for collaboration and innovation. And as Peter was saying, mentorship and development, younger employees in particular, they learn by observing, by overhearing, by getting quick feedback. And that kind of social learning largely disappears in remote settings as well.
How can organizations increase connection, collaboration, and performance while offering the flexibility employees desire? Why do leaders hold the key to making hybrid work more effective and impactful? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. Over the past 3 years, I've had the privilege of speaking with more than 150 world-class CHROs and HR thought leaders on this podcast. Those conversations have revealed something every HR leader is grappling with. How do we stay ahead, create value, and truly future-proof our organizations? And that's exactly why I created my keynote, Future-Proofing HR, creating value by unlocking the capabilities of tomorrow. It's not just a talk. It's a roadmap for transforming HR into a true value creator. I've had the privilege of keynoting HR leadership conferences for Fortune 500 companies, including AbbVie, Corning, Kohler, Nike, and LabCorp, and many more, equipping their teams with practical frameworks to challenge orthodoxies, sharpen influence, and build the capabilities that matter most for the future. If you're planning your next HR conference or leadership event, visit futureofhr.com to learn more, and let's talk about how we can make your next event a real success. My guests this week are Peter Capelli and Raina Nima, co-authors of In Praise of the Office, The Limits to Hybrid and Remote Work. Peter's a professor of the Wharton School and one of the world's leading voices on employment, talent, and performance management. He's also a two-time podcast guest. Raina is a global HR leader, strategist, and author with over 20 years of experience building inclusive workplaces and preparing organizations for the future of work. And they've come together to bring research and real-world experience to unpack why hybrid work is falling short of expectations and how leaders can make it work better. This was an insightful conversation on what many consider a controversial topic. Yet as I read their book, In Praise of the Office, what struck me is much of what they outline is much more about how we work, not where we work. I think you'll enjoy this conversation as we discussed why hybrid work isn't delivering on its promise for employees and organizations, what's been lost in remote and hybrid workplaces, including mentorship, culture, and career growth, what their research, contrary to popular belief, reveals about hybrid work and its real-world implementation, how leadership accountability is the key to making hybrid work, and the clear rules and simple fixes HR can use to strengthen hybrid work. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. So drop me a line on LinkedIn. And with that, let's join my conversation with Peter and Raina. Peter, Raina, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. You guys have boldly declared in your book that the case for in-office work has never been stronger, which might be a little controversial for some people to hear that, right? There's a lot of strong opinions in this topic, but what led you both to take this position and why do you feel compelled to write this book now?
In terms of the case being strongest now, I think the reason might be because we've gone a fair period of time now with employers just not telling employees what they were going to do. So during the pandemic, we knew you got to be remote. After that, they were saying you got to come back to the office, but then they stopped saying that, partly because the virus kept coming back. They just stopped saying anything. At this point, I think companies have feel, employers have feel they've been out long enough, they have some sense of what the issues are. They can see that it's not so terrific. And I think our point is not so much that everybody has to get back to the office and you can't have hybrid anymore, but we can't ignore the fact that being together really matters. And I think the other thing for us is that hybrid is not playing out the way we assume it is. And the big issue there is people are just not coming back. Offices on anchor days are pretty empty.
Raina, what's your perspective as well on this?
It's been now 5 years since the pandemic, and we have a much better idea now of what has worked and what has not worked during this time. I think what contributed to us writing this book is this incredibly kind of one-sided dialogue that we kept hearing about remote work. But everything has two sides, and very few people were seriously challenging or examining what are the challenges of remote or hybrid work. So, and what we might be losing by stepping away from the office, especially the social fabric that makes up the organization. So we thought this was a really good time to look into that.
One other quick thing, Rania's in Europe and has been watching things there which have not played out the way they have in the US, right? How's remote playing out in Europe, I think is the question, right? Or hybrid?
Well, I think also in Europe, I mean, it's very touch and go, because as we see in the UK, there's also a lot of traction right now of companies mandating people back to the office. Employees are not happy about it. So I think the conversation continues as well.
But in Europe, most everybody's back, right? Is the punchline?
Yeah. Central Europe for sure. Yes, definitely.
Interesting. Well, I think that you guys make a compelling case, and I think almost no one would argue about the power of being together is really important. And I think that is one of the big downsides we all experienced during COVID and remote work. So it's really interesting. And you take a research-based approach, which is great. But Peter, I did want to ask you, you both put together the HBR article, Hybrid Still Isn't Working, which was a great headline. And the article really stirred some debate on LinkedIn. And I know some consultants and even academics push back hard on your findings. I'm curious, and I want to give you the opportunity to respond to how people question the research you did. Maybe tell us more about how you did the research, because there's a lot of invested interest, I think, in people having a remote work or hybrid work, and people are just falling into their camps instead of staying open to the facts and the research. So how do you respond to that?
Well, just a quick thing, as you probably don't know unless you've written for them, HBR picks the titles. You don't pick the title. And the last iteration of the title said, hybrid is still not working well. And then they took the well off, and it made it sound more partisan than the article is. The article, I don't think, is all that partisan. It's really sort of the book story. And it's mainly about how to make hybrid work, right? The particular LinkedIn criticism you're talking about is the assertion that we didn't know the literature. And of course, we do. We wrote this book, and there are 178 references in the book, and that's not the problem, right? It was kind of a silly criticism, honestly. But I think what underpins that is lots of people believe that hybrid is working, especially for them, which is probably true. The question is not, we were not thinking about, was how is it working for the organization? We know lots of people who have it really want to keep it, and we understand that. And both of us work largely remotely, so we understand those benefits. That's never been really a topic of disagreement with people. The issue is really about how does it work for the organization.
Yeah, that's really helpful and helpful to hear that our HBR picture titles, right? I think people don't think about that, right? And I think that well would have made that article appear different, but it's understandable.
I think it's important to separate here belief from data, because what we did in the HBR article was not to say a hybrid can never work. Instead, we really presented evidence that the way hybrid is being implemented today isn't working and that there are challenges and, you know, how to overcome these challenges. So I think much of the discourse really assumes that hybrid is the best of both worlds, but our research really showed shortcomings in that. And that's what we were trying to explain as well.
There is another way to think about this problem that I don't think we have articulated maybe clearly enough. And that is, it is a cross-generation kind of a story, in that everybody who is loving hybrid, for the most part, began their careers in an office. They know how offices work. They still largely know some of the people they work with. We have another generation behind them who've come into the workplace since COVID, who have never begun their careers in an office. And if they're in hybrid organizations, and the big issue for hybrid is people not showing up, right? So you got to anchor day and nobody's there. And it's one thing to say, gee, it's great because it works for me. And also to not recognize that if you did not have that office experience in your life, and the people behind us, if hybrid continues the way it is, will have not and will not have that experience, that it's going to be just as fun for them as it is for us. And that's not true. Hard to make that argument, right?
One of the key takeaways just from our early part of this conversation that I'd remind folks is that you wrote this book, and in a lot of ways, from the employer's perspective, right? From the company's perspective. And I think a lot of us are always thinking from our perspective. Of course, we want flexibility. Of course, we want to have a hybrid or a remote situation when we want it. I think that's sort of it. We want a cake and eat it too. But from an employer's perspective, and you step back, there's things that you've lost by moving to a full remote or hybrid situation. And so I think it's very clear when you read the book that it's a balanced approach and you're focused on pragmatic solutions. Well, let's talk about what has been lost, because you guys have said things were lost as we moved away from in-office work. What have the biggest losses been and HR leaders should be paying attention to? And what are we not seeing that's happening under the surface?
I always ask when we're the group talking about this, the people who are there, if your kids came to you and said, gee, mom, dad, I've got this first job and I can either work remote or be in the office. What do you think? Everybody says be in the office. If you think about what it is you learn from being in the office, beginning your career, you learn from watching, which you can't do remotely. You can learn how interactions go, what irritates people, what makes people happy. You can learn what kinds of conversations are constructive, which ones are not. You can learn what's really going on with projects as opposed to what you might read in a memo. So you find out the culture of the place from seeing the norms and values reflected in people's behavior. And you don't get any of that if you are remote, and particularly at the beginning of your career. After that, the big things are, to what extent are you helping each other? You know, for people who are used to working remotely, and I can tell you, you know, one of the things about professors commenting on this is we are maybe the group that's the easiest to work remote because most of our work is pretty independent. If you're working with other people, it's typically not that close. You're swapping documents back and forth. So when you're talking to us, it's like, what's the big problem? But I can see in my own organization, and I can see talking to colleagues elsewhere, it's all the same. PhD students really lose out a lot because faculty are not around. So the senior people works great for us. The junior people works poorly for them. If you just ask, what do I want? I'd like to be home, which is what I'm doing today, right? But it's not so great for the junior people because they're not getting the opportunity to bounce ideas off, to watch, to learn. And collaboration is just harder. If I needed something from you and we were in the same office, I'd just go over to your desk or your office, knock on your door maybe, just stick my head in. It bothers you a little bit, but it's quick, and I can also start to read what's really going to bother you and what's not, so I get a sense of how to manage those interactions. So we've relied enormously on social skills and personal interaction to get office work done, And we never paid attention to that before.
Even simple things like the informal interactions, as Peter is saying, those quick hallway chats, the spontaneous ideas over coffee, the small signals of trust and connection that simply don't happen in a scheduled Zoom meeting. So those moments, they don't show up in like productivity dashboards or anything, but they are vital for collaboration and innovation. And as Peter was saying, mentorship and development, younger employees in particular, they learn by observing, by overhearing, by getting quick feedback. And that kind of social learning largely disappears in remote settings as well. Or it's actually just harder to replicate virtually.
And it's a great point about how it also starts to change your behavior, because none of that shows up in your KPIs. None of that shows up in your job description to say, take care of the new person when they come in. If people want help, give them help. And if it's an emergency, drop what you're doing to help them. None of that shows up. And when you're remote, starting the pandemic, we have changed people's viewpoint, really, with the big focus on your individual KPIs, which is what we told supervisors to do in the pandemic when you're starting out remote. You have to tell people what you want them to do, make sure they're doing it, measure it, all that stuff. So the other stuff which makes the office go just gets pushed to the side, and it is devalued. And in a remote context, it's easy to just skip it all together. Rather than knocking on your door, I ping you with an email. Well, you might not check your emails until the end of the day. Or if you're like my experience with our IT help, which is now remote, got a problem on the podcast. Rania's in Lebanon. You got a problem. You want to tell your IT people, can you fix this? They get back to you next week. And say, because it was in a queue, and they say, oh, so just checking on your problem on your podcast, how'd it go? It doesn't help, right?
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of the hidden benefits here in a second. I think we're hitting on a few of them. But there's a little bit of this collaboration debt that we're taking on that we didn't have before, right? With all the instant messaging, and what you start to see is because if you're remote and you're working in remote teams, everyone's using Teams or a Slack channel to ping you besides email. Maybe a phone call, maybe a text message. What you start to see is people actually either prioritizing who they respond to, or you'll see someone's screen and they may have 10 unopened, unanswered Teams or Slack messages. And that is like, wow, why? What's going on here? And I think to your point, if you had been in the office, they would have popped over and maybe in a 30-second minute conversation, you would have resolved it. But in a Teams, you have to try to give the context, understand what's happening. And it goes back and forth, and it's actually taking more time than it would to just have that conversation or pick the phone up. Is that something you saw in your research as well, in terms of how work has shifted and it's actually now taking more time to do what used to take maybe less?
For sure. Part of the reason Rania is the author here too is that she's lived this stuff in an organization as a hybrid person. And I will comment, and maybe you can tell a story or something about what you saw. I mean, I think the big thing, it seems to me, is just how much more time we spend in meetings when we are hybrid and remote. And part of the problem is I come in on an anchor day, but my peers aren't there because we don't make you come in. So then we're on Zoom anyway, even though I came into the office. It's easy for meetings to get bigger, just add people to them. Cameras off seems to be a kind of a norm. Here's the thing I just heard, which I'm sure maybe you both have seen. I have not experienced it yet. People log on to the meeting. They're not there, but they're logged on. But their agent is there taking notes. They don't even pretend to be there. What's the point of the meeting? We hear from people at the end of the meeting, people ping and say, I didn't understand what actually went on in that meeting. They have to have post-meeting meetings to explain to people what happened in the meetings. These are all problems that could be managed, but we're not managing them. And that's kind of what our book and our article is about. We got to manage these things. That's why hybrid is not working the way we think it ought to be working.
And really, there is a communication overload as well, because as you mentioned, you have so many different ways of communicating, right? So Slack and Teams and your emails, everything's pinging. You have a lot of unanswered messages. Yes, these could very simply be resolved very much quicker if you're in the office, in fact. And so this is definitely one phenomenon that I experienced myself. In addition to the meetings that Peter mentioned, excessive amount of meetings with a lot of people with their cameras off. So multitasking, which means that you need another meeting to follow up on this meeting. So there's a lot of time that is really spent on trying to make things work, whereas they could easily work much better if you were in person in these meetings or in person in the office together.
Also, one other thing about in person, if you think about conflicts, which we often have at work, right? If your conflict is virtual and you're just pinging each other back and forth, it's easy for it to get nasty and you get angry with the person. If you're looking at them face to face, people pull back their punches, as we would say, right? And things get resolved faster and much more easily. One of the things human resources people know is that if you got people who are angry or fighting with each other, if you actually get them to sit together, things get resolved much quicker, or at least the elements of the anger get pulled way back faster. If we let them just ping at each other by email, it gets worse and uglier and uglier.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And a lot of what you're pointing to, I think we've all kind of acknowledged that we're not leading the right way for this technology. We kind of learned to maybe lead. Who knows, we were leading great before the pandemic in a face-to-face, in-person world. But now that we have this hybrid remote and we've had 2+ years of remote, what are the best practices here? What should we be doing? And why haven't we made more progress on this? We've talked a lot about what to do, but we're not there yet.
Let me say why we're not making progress. And then, Ron, you can talk a little bit about what some of the best practices are. But I think this is a kind of, frankly, at the very top of the house, they are acting as if people are still in the office. That we're just trying to manage the same way. And the people at the top of the house are not thinking that this is a big organization change if you want to bring people back after a couple of years of a new normal and not saying anything and taking things away, as human resource people know, it really, really irritates people, right? It's going to demand a lot from the people at the top of different behavior. I don't think they don't want to do it for sure, but I don't think they have understood how important it is to change. Party back to your earlier point, why is this written from the perspective of the employers? Because they have all the marbles. They make all the decisions here. The employees have virtually no power. Labor market is softened a bit, so the kind of power to quit they used to have is weakening. So is up to the people at the top, and they get all the credit, but they also get all the blame, right, if it's not working.
Raina, your perspective?
In fact, there's a lot of things that can be done, which are just small, actionable things that really would help. Just something like setting clear and enforceable rules. This is also what we mentioned in the article as well. Some issues like for newcomers or for how to onboard them, make sure they are onboarded together. There's just such simple things that one can do, actually, that could really help to make a hybrid definitely more effective.
So here's my top two. Make people come in on anchor days, number one. You can't have a million exceptions. And the second is change the rules on meetings. So set the rules that we should always have had on meetings, but immediately cameras on. If your cameras aren't on, then don't attend the meeting. You really don't need to be there. If you're holding meetings where people could literally just send an agent to take notes, then you shouldn't have a meeting at all. It's just send a memo out to tell people what's said, right? So those are the two I would do. You could do them tomorrow. They're not that hard. And why it isn't happening is worth thinking about.
Yeah, the camera off one really is a pet peeve for me because it feels just so disingenuous and you're not there. It's strange because you feel like I'm not sure there's even a in-person parallel. I guess it's maybe I'm having a meeting, but you turn around and look the other way. That's what it sort of feels like. I know you're there, you're listening, but you're not with me and engaging, and I just don't understand it. And I've asked people because I've had some consulting experience where people have had these calls and some people are on, camera's not on, and I ask, why are you not turning your camera on? They said, well, if it's a larger meeting, we turn our cameras off. And so I think that's cultural. I mean, these are leadership behaviors that you have to say, hey, this is how we operate, and you've got to cascade that down to your point, Peter, that it is a new way of leading. And I think we talked a lot about where we work, but a lot of leaders, and I'm more pointing to CEOs and the business leaders, wouldn't acknowledge that we have to think about how we work differently and get clear on it because it requires them to change, which isn't always easy to do. So I think they're really good points there. Raina, what about you? For you, are there a top two or three you would implement right away?
I would focus honestly on, which I think we're going to discuss anyway, but on revamping how you measure performance. But I think we'll get into that in a minute anyway. And also things like career planning and advancements, because they also require some different practices in order to be successful.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because that's where I was going to go next, was around, and we talked a little bit about the fact how difficult it is to start your career, first job and fully remote job, because you don't learn. And I did see that in the pandemic myself, and I thought it was challenging to try to mentor and coach somebody. But let's talk more about, Raina, what you want to go into there around the challenges of career growth, promotions. Are we holding people back because they're remote? Do people who are face-to-face get an oversized advantage? What did you see from the research?
We do see there is some level of proximity bias, of course, out of sight, out of mind. If you are working remotely the whole time and you don't have clear instructions or clear KPIs, then it's very easy not to be visible to management. So when it comes to promotion time, maybe you could be overlooked. So proximity bias is definitely something that is real. Then, of course, we see maybe managers are also not conscious about that as well, right? But they tend to reward maybe visibility more than performance or outcomes. Who's in the office? Who speaks up in meetings? Maybe they bump into in the hallway. So this creates invisible barriers to growth for remote employees.
A simple thing, back to Rania's earlier point about measuring performance, we should just tell people these other things matter. Do you respond and help out your peers? Do you look after the new hires when they come in? These are all part of your job. We never put them in job descriptions because they happened naturally through social relationships. But if you don't have those social relationships, we probably have to spell them out. It's remarkable how much change you can get just by telling people these matter and we are watching them. Related to this point about development is if you don't see people, how people interact with their peers, you don't have a good sense of what they're going to be like as a supervisor. So the first level promotion, for example, right? Who gets to be a supervisor? And I certainly heard this in remote offices that people would say, how did that person get promoted? Because they knew the person from before and they knew they didn't get along with anybody well in the office context. But their KPIs from hybrid remote context were great, so they got promoted. What are you going to do instead? You don't want that to keep happening. So it's a challenge for management to figure out how we're going to assess not just performance, but the criteria for advancement, which is part of performance too.
Yeah, I think great points. And I also think there's a little bit of a meritocracy myth that some people have in the remote work world of this happened in the pandemic a little bit. I'm going to deliver great work and my work matters and you're seeing me produce work and I'm answering my emails and I'm producing my outputs and that should get me promoted. But what we all know is, to your point, there's this social game. It's how do you lead? How do you interact? And it's really hard to see how someone could even lead a meeting if it's virtual. How do you assess that potential in a virtual type meeting? It's very different, a face-to-face meeting, what happens afterwards, how do they handle themselves? When you're looking at leadership, we're assessing those softer, more intangible criteria. It's not surprising that people expect, I want to see you do this, not just do it on a video call.
That's a great point about meetings. One of the things one of the managers told me in a hybrid place was, you can't tell with a remote meeting when you're losing the audience because everybody's camera's off. If it's face-to-face, you can tell pretty quickly. At least if camera's on, they all start flicking their camera off. That's what that tells you something. But if everybody's camera is off, you have no idea how it's going. You can't even adjust. Right?
Let's talk about AI a little bit. And I'm just curious, and I didn't really see this in the book, but I'm asking because I think AI is impacting everything. And I think it's a question most people would like to ask. Is AI having an impact or does it have a role in this debate at all? Do you see this impacting where we work and the technology? Did that come up at all in your research?
This is a topic I'm working on now, so maybe I could say a few things about it. And basically, what we are learning now is how much our ideas have been driven by the hype. Maybe not too surprising, but the hype all comes from people who have built the tools, and they're telling you what the tools can do. So I always like to remind people about driverless trucks, which we were told by 2019 would take over. And I know companies and HR people who were told to develop plans in 2018 for how to deal with all the unemployed truck drivers, right? Well, if you actually thought not about what is possible, but what is practical, you never would have thought that driverless trucks were going to get anywhere. And I think the same problem we're seeing now with broader AI, when you look at where it's actually being used, it turns out it's really expensive to use a lot of these tools. It's not ChatGPT to do anything sophisticated. And it turns out the simple things, trying to automate simple paper tasks, require an enormous amount of computer power because they have to be right every time. ChatGPT just has to be better than what you know now on a topic you don't know much about. Okay, so not bad. But if you're trying to say, this is a claim, this is a dispute in terms of sorting paper, it can't just be okay. It's got to be right all the time. That means you got to build and train the algorithm. It's a ton of time and a ton of effort to do that. And I think where we are seeing it now actually being used most is actually on the white collar side, not the lower level jobs. To do that well requires unbundling the job and thinking about all the tasks people perform. Where can you insert an agent in that task and then reassemble the job afterwards? And the person who does that job has to help the agent figure out, are you giving me the right stuff or not? So it ends up being an enormous work organization task, which is good for HR and probably good generally. It's not eliminating jobs. But I think back to your particular question about remote work, does it matter much? I think we have not thought very much about that. I think not only us, but most anybody. But the move toward AI in chatbots in particular is removing the human from conversations that were typically never face-to-face in the first place. Does it matter much if you get a smarter chatbot response or an in-person response? I don't know. If more work that was face-to-face starts moving to chatbots, then maybe the difference between being remote and being in the office where you weren't interacting quite so much is not quite so important if more tasks are pushed out. But the remaining tasks, you know, the jobs are not going away. I mean, they're literally not. You still need help on those tasks. You still care about the other people, and so you don't want to disappoint them. All those things, as long as there is a need to be in person, the issues don't change very much.
Yeah, very helpful. Really helpful to hear your perspective on AI. And if you've got more writing to come on that, I think that's great. I'm actually in the same place when I think about this. I've tried to build my own AI agents. I've taken courses on it. So I wanted to see how hard it would be for HR people to do it. But I didn't have the instructor to tell me what to do on the next step. I would never be able to get past the really sticking points because it wasn't that easy. And then to your point of what it was really doing, it wasn't super complicated either. And I think when you start breaking down tasks, there's a lot of nuance that goes into the jobs and decisions we make that we don't even think about. There could be hundreds of decisions, even putting together an email and judgment calls that are thought through.
And I guess the other point, JP, if they didn't have you, that instructor could never do it either. You have to have somebody who really knows the job and what's involved in it, or you're not going to get anywhere. The myth, which people at the top of the house really jumped into, is that these tools are free and you can just pop them in and jobs will go away. That was the myth, and it's turning out not to be true. I don't know if you saw this survey done about a month ago reporting that 74% of C-suite executives thought they were going to lose their job in 2 years if they couldn't prove that they're basically cutting headcount with AI. And that's all coming from boards who think this is a simple thing to do, and it's not.
Well, great. I'm glad we had a little detour on AI. I do want to talk about the book again, because there's something in there. You have a great quick reference guide that helps people think through and organizations think through, should you go remote, hybrid, or in office? Maybe just talk through a little bit of the framework, but also how do you think about what is right for your organization? Because some organizations are much more probably ready to be remote or hybrid. Some need to be more in person.
Yeah, in the book, we argue that the decision about whether to be in office or remote or hybrid, it shouldn't be guesswork. It needs a framework. You have to obviously match the model to your organization, perhaps using a few lenses. One of them is to assess the work itself, the nature of the work, because as we know, some jobs simply require physical presence, access to equipment, high levels of collaboration, the kind of spontaneous exchange that we mentioned that sparks innovation. And those, obviously, for that, the office would add value. The second thing to look at is obviously your workforce, the employee demographics. You have to look at what your employees need and how you can help them with that. So younger workers, as we mentioned, often want mentoring and visibility that comes with the office. So while perhaps others who have long commutes or so forth may long more for flexibility. Third is to look at the organization itself, the culture of the organization, culture, trust, leadership, style, they play a huge role in this. So if your culture thrives on collaboration, going fully remote could really erode it. And finally, also competitive pressures, because no decision exists in a vacuum, as we know. So if all your peers are offering flexibility and you don't, then you may lose talent. But if your industry is primarily in office, being too flexible can also leave you a bit out of sync. So this is kind of a bit of a decision framework that we look at. There's a step further than this, so please go ahead and then I will mention that.
Well, I was just going to say something slightly different. The one thing we didn't talk about, but I would do, is to use guilt. And guild works as follows with the senior people, because they want to move to Aspen and just never come into the office, but to remind them that someone helped you. You wouldn't be where you are if people didn't take you under their wing early on, show you the ropes, help you figure out what to do. If you didn't have people you could ping things off of, and I bet you're not doing that very often with anybody now. So you have some responsibility to help other people. I think this is intergenerational problem. The people who want to be hybrid don't quite realize that it affects the people below them because we're not there. Why not? Guilt seems to work in other places.
Yeah, pay it forward. I think it makes sense.
So when we talked about this framework, one thing that we suggest in the book also is the challenge of how do you make, if you want people to return to the office, how exactly would you do that? And we introduce something called the bond framework, where you really build the case. So you shift the story from returning to the office to enhancing career growth and connections. Show people how in-person supports networks, learning and innovation, for example. You own the expectation. So be really clear about the activities that really need in-person, for example, participation, and model that from the top. Normalize engagement. Make office attendance feel natural, not forced. So by really building collaborative and social touch points. And finally, demonstrate inclusion. So make sure that coming back doesn't feel like rigid or one size fits all, to really make employees feel heard, valued, safe. This is also what we suggest in the book as well.
Yeah, really, really helpful. Is there anyone who's doing this really well that's been a role model that you know of that maybe you can point to?
We learned a lot from the folks at Neiman Marcus, who had done it quite well, and they were largely remote. And they might say that they were permanently remote. However, they spent a lot of money and time creating regional headquarters and budgets for bringing everybody to those headquarters on a regular basis. They didn't have anchor days, but they had periods of intense, you have to be there, meetings and collaborations every quarter and stuff. And it fit their business model because they were quite smart, realizing that the pandemic created a recruiting opportunity for them. Neiman Marcus, most of their shoppers were women. They were looking for women executives. They targeted women executives with children to say, okay, this is an audience. We're going to go grab these people, and we think we can get them because we're offering them this opportunity to be largely at home. And we want their perspective. That's our audience. I think there, what was good about it is they thought the whole thing through. What's our business goal? What kind of people do we need? It's exactly what you hope HR would do if it's strategic. Where are we going to get those people? How do we get a value proposition unique to them? And then how do we make the thing work? So they spent some money and some support from the very top to do it. The problem is you don't see many people doing this well. If you look at the surveys from employers, for example, about attendance, 70%+ or so said that they have real problems with attendance. And as I recall, the majority said they didn't even have a clear attendance policy. So they're just not spending time. They're just assuming it must be working. And they're not looking, which is never going to get you in a good place.
Lots of opportunity here. Peter and Rania, the last question for you. What is one word or phrase you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I would say humanization, because as we've talked now about AI and automation as well, and what tasks are going to be done also by AI and so forth, I think HR's true role will really also need to bring the human back to work, building trust, empathy, connections, so forth. And that's why that would be my word. So it's not just about digitization, but also humanizing the workplace.
Following that, I would say that is the big issue, the battle. So maybe the battle, I would say. And that is, are you going to do that or not? And I think in the US, we have a strong push from the C-suite, the CEOs and investor community, to not do any of that. Tightest labor market in a couple of generations for the last few years, and we're laying off people, we're squeezing them harder, we've got mental health challenges, we're bringing in AI because we think it'll cut jobs, we're backing off of things like lean production, which was enormously successful because we don't want to empower employees. It's the rise of the engineers in top leadership, engineer thinking. Engineers can be great leaders if they know something about management. If they don't, you got a problem. So that battle, I think, between that view and the humanization Rania is talking about is going to be the defining issue after that. So it's going on the next 5 years, 10 years after that, it's who wins that battle that's going to be the story.
Very insightful, Peter. Rania, thank you both for being on the podcast. The book is In Praise of the Office, another battle people are fighting, office versus remote or hybrid. It's been an incredible conversation. Thank you both.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Peter and Rania for such a candid and timely conversation on why hybrid work isn't living up to expectations and how leaders can fix it. Be sure to check out their new book, In Praise of the Office, The Limits to Hybrid and Remote Work, for more insights and actual ideas on how to make work just work better. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and your business impact. So go to futureofhr.com to subscribe and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100+ HR thought leaders that's simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with another amazing guest, Tomas Shamiro-Permusic. Tomas is one of my favorite people, one of my favorite authors, and a returning guest on the podcast. He's written 10 books, including his latest, Don't Be Yourself, Why Authenticity is Overrated and What to Do Instead. It's a bold and thought-provoking take on why just be yourself is bad career advice and what leaders should do instead. You won't want to miss this conversation. Thanks again for being part of the Future of HR community.